This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know around here we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where long-term performance is driven by original, fundamental research on a global scale. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Here we are. It's H Day, Healthcare Day for the White House, the president's big speech to Congress.
So tonight I want to talk to you about the principles that I believe must embody our efforts to reform America's healthcare system.
Wait, sorry, wrong president. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constant Contact, dedicated to helping small businesses and nonprofits build strong customer relationships with email marketing and online surveys, ConstantContact.com. And by the American Payroll Association, thanking payroll professionals during National Payroll Week, September 7th through the 11th. More at NationalPayrollWeek.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It is Wednesday today, the 9th of September, and it is, as always, great to have you here. 16 years ago this month, President Clinton made the trip from the White House to Capitol Hill to rescue his health care plan. Barack Obama is set to do the same thing tonight, all the while hoping for a better outcome. The president is expected to make the case once again for the public option, a government-run health insurance program. To do that, he's probably going to have to be more specific than he has been about what a health care overhaul might cost, what it might look like, and then he's going to have to tell us how we're going to pay for it. Marketplace's Tamara Keith has our preview.
Will there be a public plan or won't there? Will the president accept a bill without one? Ah, the suspense just keeps building. Thomas Mann is a senior fellow at the left-leaning Brookings Institution.
I recommend to pundits, to journalists, to everyone to relax.
Mann says this will all get worked out eventually when the House and the Senate reconcile their bills. But in his speech tonight, President Obama isn't giving up any ground on a public plan. He's expected to lay out how it would work. He'll also reassure everyone that they can keep their doctors or a health plan they like. In short, Mann says the speech needs to clarify and energize.
To return to the reform effort, a sense of excitement about doing something that's absolutely essential and likely constructive for our future.
Republicans aren't likely to hear much they support, but pleasing them doesn't seem to be much of a priority anymore. Today, Max Baucus, chairman of the Senate Finance Committee, the last committee trying to work out a compromise with Republicans, came close to admitting defeat.
I very much hope and do expect Republicans would be on board. I don't know how many, but if there are not any, I'm going to move forward in any event.
Republicans or no, Baucus said his bill will not contain a government-run insurance plan. In Washington, I'm Tamara Keith for Marketplace.
Outside the Beltway, the corporate news of the day came with fries and a Coke. McDonald's unveiled quarterly profits this morning. Investors were left less than completely satisfied. Sales growth slowed here in the United States. It fell outright in Asia. But if you're thinking to yourself right about now, hang on just a second, because a couple of months ago, I heard this story on Marketplace about how McDonald's was going to do just fine in this recession. You did hear that story. But the change in fortunes at the Golden Arches speaks to how even the best positioned brands can get themselves into trouble. From Washington, Marketplace's Steve Hanna reports. Rafael Rodriguez is the kind of customer McDonald's executives used to call a heavy user. He comes a lot.
At least twice or three times a week, yes. It's quick, easy, drive-through.
And it's pretty affordable.
Get the Egg McMuffin, large orange juice, and my hash brown.
For $5.18. Meals like that were supposed to make Mickey D's immune to this economic downturn. McDonald's was one of the only stocks to actually gain value in 2008. Or at least that was the story from restaurant analysts like Tom Forte at the Telsey Group.
So I think what you had initially was a consumer who is trading down from TGI Fridays and Applebee's and Ruby Tuesday and others into McDonald's and Burger King.
We were all supposed to trade our Starbucks for McCafés. But recently, Rodriguez, who frequents a McDonald's on Grand Avenue in Los Angeles, noticed a change in the morning crowd.
Yes, you could tell there's less people.
Turns out the Great Recession is hurting McDonald's, too. Unemployment topped 9.7% last month. And if you lump in folks whose hours have been cut, nearly one in six Americans is unemployed or underemployed. Analyst Tom Forte.
Now, by necessity, given the high rate of unemployment, you're seeing consumers opting out of all forms of dining away from home.
Forte says we're all trading down again, this time giving up Big Macs for cans of Chef Boyardee. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
I'm just guessing here, but I'd say you probably won't see too many Big Macs in New York's Bryant Park this week. Fashion Week starts tomorrow when designers show off their collections for next spring. Based on what the recession has done to most of the fashion industry, you might expect the looks to be subdued. But Sally Herships reports there is a hint of recovery on the runway.
I'm at the New York City loft and workspace of Stephen Cox and Daniel Silver. They're the designers behind the menswear line Ducky Brown. Clothing racks, bolts of fabric, and shoeboxes line the walls. Silver says the recession played a big role in their designs last season. Clothes were simple and dark.
And we made sure that we did a lot of pieces that were very protective, very classic pieces that people could wear for a very, very, very long time and feel that they got the best bang for their buck.
The designers say this season, while they won't raise prices, they do want to show something more hopeful and open, like a pair of men's shorts Cox shows me.
It's a huge bow on a short. A big, big bow, big bow. I mean, so it's like, I don't know, it's like a huge present.
Mark Karamzada is designer sportswear editor at Women's Wear Daily. He says designers are still hanging by a thread, no pun intended, so they're adding special pieces, like the bow short. But they're also widening the price ranges and using fabrics that can be worn over multiple seasons.
Stores are asking designers to tightly edit their collections, and I wouldn't be surprised if we're going to see lesser pieces but more meaningful pieces.
Karamzada says we won't see a lot of flashy clothes.
Because this is just not the time to go out and present that kind of mindset.
But designer Cesar Galindo says he's not holding back.
No, I'm not. I'm actually having more fun with it now because it's a moment to do that.
Galindo says he thinks it's time to make pieces that stand out. He'll be showing dresses with an 80s look straight out of Dynasty, metallic foiled linen, and polka dots.
The basics are in your closet. If I'm going to buy a t-shirt, I want it to be on sale. If I'm going to buy a really incredible jacket, I want it to be really incredible because I don't have
it. Tell me about your show, the production of your show itself. Are you keeping that more scaled down or is that going over
the
top?
No, it's over the top. Why do you want to see a boring show?
Boring? That's so last season. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Maybe it's just me. I'm going to have to draw a line with those shorts with the bows on them. On Wall Street today, no bows. Some bells and whistles, though. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. This may be more macroeconomic detail than you want, but the Federal Reserve splits this country into 12 parts or regions. About every 8 weeks, it publishes something called the Commentary on Current Economic Conditions, otherwise known as the Beige Book. It's a look at the U.S. economy broken down by those 12 districts. And the report that came out today says things in 11 of the 12 are distinctly positive, except for the labor market, which is a big exception. Commentator Robert Reich says whatever economic recovery there may eventually be depends on jobs.
According to last Friday's jobs report, almost one out of six Americans who needs a full-time job either can't find one or is working part-time. Meanwhile, wage growth among people who have jobs has just about stopped. And the typical work week is now so short, at just over 33 hours, that if and when companies need workers, they'll just expand the hours of people already on payrolls rather than hire anyone new. Bottom line, no net new private sector jobs, probably for years. Does this mean a jobless recovery? No. It means no recovery, at least none lasting beyond inventory corrections and the government stimulus. You see, with so many people unemployed or underemployed, there won't be enough demand to fuel a recovery. But according to a recent report by Bank of America Merrill Lynch, we shouldn't worry. 42% of consumer spending before the meltdown came from the top earning 10% of Americans. And not too surprising, given that the top 10% was raking in half of total earnings. So as long as the top continues to do relatively well, says Bank of America, their spending will revive the economy. And the top 10% isn't being hit nearly as badly by job losses, and their wages are doing relatively well. Plus, their wealth isn't as dependent on home values, as is everyone else's. While housing prices continue to decline, the stock market has rallied. The report warns against raising taxes on the top 10%, lest their consuming ardor be dampened. This logic is morally and economically indefensible. If we learned anything from the Great Meltdown, it's that the skewing of income and wealth to the top has made our economy far less stable. Stagnant median wages, widening inequality, and job insecurity got us into this mess in the first place. And until we deal with them head on, the mess will remain.
Robert Reich is a professor of public policy at the University of California, Berkeley. Your thoughts are always welcome. Write to us at marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. Of all the economic numbers, reports, and statistics that you hear on this program, one is used way more than any other. The often repeated claim, here and elsewhere, that consumer spending makes up 70% of the American economy. Business Week magazine's chief economist Michael Mandel has heard business journalists use that phrase one time too many, so he did what economists do and added it up for himself and blogged about it. And he says the real number is a good deal lower than 70%. Mike, it's good to talk to you.
Oh, glad to be here.
First things first, we're not just making this number up, right? The Department of Commerce is the one who comes out with this 70% of GDP figure.
Well, what happens is that the Bureau of Economic Analysis, which is part of the Department of Commerce, publishes what they call personal consumption expenditures, and those come to 70% of GDP. And that's why people talk about consumer spending being 70% of economic activity.
Okay, break it down for me then, because that's what you did in this blog post last week.
It turns out that personal consumption expenditures actually include all sorts of things that really aren't what we think of as consumer spending. I mean, for example, when you go out and you buy a haircut, that's pretty straightforward. You're paying for the time of somebody who lives and works in the U.S. But what if you go out and you buy a clock radio, which is made by somebody in the Philippines? Well, that's consumer spending for sure, but it doesn't correspond completely to economic activity in the U.S. You're spending the money for sure, but it's not turning into U.S. economic activity.
There's no dollar-for-dollar correlation there.
There's no dollar-for-dollar correlation. In fact, maybe half the dollars you spend are actually translate into U.S. economic activity. Then the other thing is that the BEA uses the personal consumption expenditure category as kind of a catch-all for all sorts of other things that, frankly, you and I would not think of as consumer spending.
Yeah, you had some great examples. I mean, rent basically is one of those, right?
Well, what happens is, suppose you own your own home. According to the way that the numbers are done, they count it as if you are paying rent to yourself. We also have all of the health care expenditures in this country. So take Medicare, for example. Mm-hmm. You and I think about that as a government expenditure.
Sure.
But from the point of view of the government statisticians, they count it as consumer spending.
Get me to the moral of the story then. I mean, after you did all this math and you broke it down and you added it up, is there a way for us to think of direct out-of-my-pocket consumer spending and how much that impacts gross domestic product?
consumer spending, out-of-pocket expenses are probably closer to 40% of GDP than to 70%. And the reason why this is important is because if you say 70%, then you think, oh, heavens, there's no way that the U.S. can grow as long as consumers are strapped.
Did you call the BEA, the Commerce Department, and say, hey, listen, your figures are a little funny here?
I have a long-time continuing dialogue with the wonderful folks at the BEA. I actually think that this is not so much their problem, but it's a disjunction between the media and the statistics, which is that there's ways that economists do things that make sense to them, and then it gets translated kind of off in the media. And this is a particularly bad one at this point because you don't want to give people the impression that we have to be a consumer-driven economy. We don't have to be. We are not totally right now. And you sort of say, okay, how else can we grow? There are other ways to grow.
Michael Mandel from Business Week. Mike, thanks so much.
Oh, you're so welcome.
Coming up, a British baby boom gone bust.
Younger women, indigenous middle-class women, deciding to have children earlier, so perhaps deciding that it isn't all about career.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials rose 49 points today, about a half percent, closed at 95.47. The Nasdaq climbed 22 points, that's 1.1%, ended the day at 2060. The S&P 500 up 7 points, 0.75%, finished at 1033. That's an 11-month high for the S&P, by the way. Financials did well with Morgan Stanley up 2.7%. AIG was up more than 8% today. Capital One rose 5.75% based on a boost in credit spending. MasterCard also rose 1.33% on that news. eBay did well on the Wall Street auction block today, jumping 3.8%. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose 3.47%, and you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals, institutions, and advisors reach their long-term goals at Vanguard.com. And by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. Why is a cram down like a slice of cake? Visit the Marketplace whiteboard to find out. It's on our website, marketplace.org. There you'll find videos unwrapping the basics of the financial crisis.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. The International Energy Agency releases its monthly oil market report on supply and demand around the world. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on trade for July. And it's World Suicide Prevention Day. According to the World Health Organization, nearly 1 million people die from suicide each year. This year's theme is about prevention in different cultures. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. Even if direct consumer spending only accounts for 40% of the economy, the fact is that we've all been doing a lot less spending during this recession. And partly as a result, the advertising industry has taken a beating. Still, though, companies are spending billions of dollars every year getting their message out. They're on TV, in magazines, on billboards, and on the internet. But all of those ads start with the same basic principles: art and copy. As it happens, that's the title of director Doug Prey's new documentary about the heyday of advertising back in the 1960s. He explained the art part for us and the copy.
For years and years and years, there was always the artist, the person who did the layouts and did the kind of graphic treatment of an ad. And then there was the writer, the guy who came up with the catchy
Yeah. The copy, right?
The copy.
Yeah.
And what happened in the 60s is a guy named Bill Birnbach at Doyle Dane Birnbach kind of put the two together and are in the same room together as if they should never have met. And an amazing thing happened, and it kind of exploded a new creative revolution in advertising.
Why didn't anybody think to do that before?
In the old days of advertising, it was driven more by the account. Mm-hmm. And just information. It was all about just, well, you got a car. It does 12 new things this year. We just got to tell people about the 12 new things and have a pretty picture. So you do the pretty picture and we'll tell them about the 12 new things. I mean, there were some great, amazing ads in the 20s, 30s, and 40s. But in the 60s, for the very first time, advertising kind of said, wait a minute. Let's do something that's completely different, something that's wildly entertaining, or just – it was like, why do we have to sit there and give them a bunch of information? Let's just inspire them, and maybe they'll be inspired to do what the client wants us to do, which is have them go out and buy a bunch of stuff.
You know, you profile a woman in this film named Mary Wells, who was at Doyle Dane Birnbach for a while, founded her own firm. And she is quoted actually as saying this period, the 50s and 60s in advertising, were a perky period in the advertising industry. Do you agree with that?
I think there was a time in the 60s where advertising was incredibly dynamic, probably very fun to work in, and actually really cool. As Mary Wells says, the Beatles were here, the Stones were here, you know, everything was possible suddenly. Like, you know, why not take an airline? Why do airlines have to be dull? Why did airlines have to be just these, like, steel-wrapped kind of dull things? And this is really what she says in the movie. Yeah. But, you know, why not just paint them crazy colors and do ads for them that are just, like, at this point, frankly, ridiculous, but were really entertaining at the time.
We have blue planes, orange planes, yellow planes. You can fly with us 7 times and never fly the same color twice. Inside 7 different color schemes. And since we fly to Mexico and South America, art from Peru, Brazil, and Argentina. Cha-cha-cha.
All of a sudden, it seemed like it was okay to have a hell of a lot of fun with advertising.
Do you think advertising is the same way today?
No.
Why?
Myself, Shirley, and everybody in the movie would agree that 98% of most advertising is pretty much garbage. A lot of businesses, and certainly advertising, has kind of fallen prey to like this idea that market research and analysis and everything is what it's all about. And if you can figure out exactly what the customers are already buying, then you can figure out exactly what they're going to buy, and then you know how to advertise it.
How much of the way consumers think about advertising today, which is largely negative, is because we are just so jaded now because we're just bombarded by this stuff all the time. And most of it, as you said before, is dreck.
I personally think there's way, way, way too much of it. But I think there's too much media. I think there's too much everything.
Hey, thanks for coming on the show. Appreciate that.
Too much everything. But I have to say I have a pretty huge filter for ads. If they're great, if they grab me and I go, wow, that was really cool, or it makes me laugh, then I stand back. And I don't know if I'm going to go buy the product necessarily, but I definitely behold something like, hey, that spoke to me. And when that happens, I don't care anymore that it's an ad or a painting or a poem or a rock song or whatever. I don't care. It's a person who figured out how to take all the powers that be and all the commerce around them and say something directly to me. And that's kind of what the movie's about. It basically, the whole theory is if you hate advertising, make better ads.
The latest offering from filmmaker Doug Prey is called Art and Copy, about the advertising industry. Doug, thanks a lot for coming in.
Thank you very much.
Things are booming over in the UK. Nothing economic, of course. They've been in the same recession we have for the past year or more. We're talking babies here. British births are up. Pair that with rising immigration and Britain seeing its biggest annual increase in population in almost 50 years. The way things are going, Britain could eventually overtake Germany as Europe's most heavily populated country. But depending on who you ask, that is not necessarily a net positive. From London Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
I will be faithful.
I will be faithful.
To Her Majesty.
To Her Majesty.
In a wood-panelled council chamber in the northern London borough of Brent, a group of immigrants swear an oath of allegiance to the Queen. They are now proud British citizens.
I'm from India, and being a British citizen is, I feel very important to achieve that. It's been a long dream.
I'm from Brazil. It's an honor to become a British citizen.
It means the most in the world for me to settle here and raise a family, so it's just fantastic.
There's been a huge influx of immigrants into Britain, 2.3 million over the past decade and a half. But over the past year, there's been a different trend. A baby boom has overtaken immigration as the main driver of population growth. Immigrant mothers account for most of the extra births.
I've got already one kid here. She's 1 year old. So already my family has started, so I'm happy.
We want to next year. Now that we're British, we feel that we can start our family, so finally it's next year.
I already got a son here, yeah, and I intend to have another one.
Immigration and immigrant birth rates are not the whole story, however. There's been a sharp rise in the number of births to British-born women as well. Anastasia Duval of the think tank Civitas says there's something very interesting going on.
Younger women, indigenous middle-class women, deciding to have children earlier, so perhaps deciding that it isn't all about career. Having children is now a priority. Therefore, we see more people getting married and more people having children.
Not everyone is celebrating Britain's booming birth rate. Norman Myers is a professor of development economics here at Oxford University. He specialises in sustainability. He doesn't regard every extra baby as a little bundle of joy, but just another carbon emitter.
More people means more pollution, but more pressure on the climate system. It means all kinds of adverse pressures.
Myers believes that a population of 61.4 million and rising is nothing short of a disaster.
I believe that Britain certainly has enough people already, and we might be better off with fewer people. I think it's deplorable that our population total is steadily growing in Britain. It should be going the other way.
Retired diplomat Sir Andrew Green is another naysayer when it comes to population growth. He says that with current levels of immigration and fertility, the UK will have 70 million people within two decades. The country will be the most populous and densely populated in Europe.
England is already 12 times as crowded as the United States, four times as crowded as France, and it causes a whole range of problems. Some of them are to do with the shortage of housing, the effect on the environment and the quality of life.
I, Kamakshi Murali.
I, Murali Ramdas.
I, Seema Patel.
There could be fewer citizenship ceremonies like this in future. The government claims it does now have immigration under control. Because of the recession, immigrants, especially from Eastern Europe, have been losing their jobs and leaving Britain. So net migration is lower. But with the rising birth rate, the population continues to grow, and with it, widespread public anxiety. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering absolute return funds with goals designed to match yours. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note before we go today, my initial inclination was that we were going to pass on the big Apple event that's happening up in San Francisco today. That company and its CEO get enough free publicity as it is. But then I watched Steve Jobs come out on stage in his trademark black turtleneck, as always. After his liver transplant, Jobs is very thin, his voice is raspy, but he got a standing ovation from the Apple faithful in his first public appearance. For what it's worth, no real news from the company today, although Apple shares did hit a 52-week high above $174 apiece. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow packed on 49 points, a half of 1%. The Nasdaq rose 22 points, that's 1.1%. The S&P 500 added 7 points, 0.75%. Mahan Baladuni, Ravi Karman, Stephen Colon, Andrea Jackson-Gewertz, Eric Johnson, Jeff Peters, and Charlton Thorpe engineered the program for us. Coming up next time, how believing in the financial system got us into the credit crisis and how it may get us out.
At the end of the day, finance is all about faith. Money does not exist unless you believe in it. Otherwise, it's just a bit of paper.
The collapse of Lehman Brothers 1 year later and how it changed our faith in finance. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow. We'll be right back.
American Public Media.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.